In the run-up to Valentine's Day of 2015, I found myself with a rather unfamiliar feeling. Loneliness. From 2010 onwards, I'd been so focused on med school that I was content to barely have a social life and content to have a non-existent romantic life. I told myself that it could all wait until I was done with school, and that frankly, it would be irresponsible for me to curate distractions for myself while I was trying to reach the first milestone in my career goals. But after most of my high school friends had graduated and my social media feed began to swell with pictures of their dates, weddings, and pregnancy pictures, I began to feel like that I was really missing out. Call it social pressure or just plain loneliness, but I began to tell myself that it wouldn't be terrible if I just did a little casual dating, especially around the most romantic time of the year. So I did what most younger folks my age do, and I downloaded one or two of the more popular dating apps. Being a woman and all, I didn't have any trouble getting matches. The trouble was actually finding a guy I liked after the opening conversation. So many of them seemed either too into it or clingy or way too cool and uninterested. The last thing I wanted was someone who'd badger me during intense periods of study, but I also didn't want to just be some player's option either. I know that sounds like I was asking for the impossible, and trust me, for a while, I thought I was being way too picky. But then came a guy that we'll call Ryan, and I only give him a fake name to protect the innocent. Ryan seemed charming, intelligent, and respectful, but he also took a while to answer my messages. I know that last part seems like a weird thing to count as a virtue, but I wanted a guy who had his own stuff going on. I liked the idea that he was sometimes just too busy to talk, and I guess that's because I saw a little of myself in him, but I digress. Out of all the guys I spoke to, Ryan was 100% the leading candidate. So there came a point where I straight up asked him if he had any Valentine's Day plans. I'm quick to add that I didn't ask him out, I just asked if he had plans, then waited for him to take the hint. Thankfully, he did, and he told me he knew of this cute little Portuguese bistro-type place that did some of the best seafood he'd ever had. Now, he didn't know this. I have the most boring, anglophone surname ever, but I'm actually a quarter Portuguese. So, I basically jumped on the offer and got super excited for the date. Valentine's Day fell on a Saturday that year, and I remember that because we ended up having to stew on a waiting list before our reservation was confirmed. Obviously, the will-we-won't-we drama had me even more excited than before, and when the time came to actually go meet him, I was feeling very romantic indeed. He looked amazing too. Three-piece suit, perfect hair, plus a little tactical stubble that accentuated his masculinity. Then, when he took off his jacket, hung it over the back of his chair, then rolled the sleeves of his white shirt up. My God. I thought I was going to explode with desire right then and there. We talked, picked out some appetizers, and for about 45 minutes, the date was going incredibly well. But then, I saw two people walk into the bistro that looked very, very out of place. Ryan had his back to the door, so he didn't see them walk in, but I did. And right away, their state trooper uniform stuck out like a sore thumb. I'm sure you know the kind I'm talking about. The smoky bear hat with the super shiny tie clip thing. But as much as they initially grabbed my attention, I didn't want to be rude and interrupt Ryan in the middle of an anecdote. He definitely noticed me looking over his shoulder, but they were nothing but momentary glances, so not nearly enough for him to stop talking and looking around. Out of my peripheral vision, I see the cops being greeted by the restaurant's maitre d'. Then, I see the maitre d' pointing in our general direction. But again, nothing to be too concerned about. But then, the two cops started walking past a row of tables in our direction, and this is when I have to break eye contact and look up at them, because they stop right next to our table. Again, I've changed some of the details to protect the innocent.
"Sir?"
one of them said. Ryan looked up before the cop continued.
"Are you Ryan Smith of 111 Residential Street?"
Ryan responded in the affirmative, then asked if there was a problem. My heart and mind are both racing by this point, and in those few split seconds, I figured something terrible had happened to someone Ryan knew. That, or there had been like a break-in at his home or something. I never, ever would have guessed what the cops said next. Not in a million years. Then, as almost everyone in the restaurant is looking at us, wait and kitchen staff included, one of the cops says,
"Ryan Smith, I'm arresting you on suspicion of the murder of..."
Enter girl's name here.
"You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law,"
etc., etc., etc. And I think my jaw must have been touching the tablecloth as I felt my face burning with embarrassment. Like I said, almost everyone in the bistro was looking at Ryan as the cops walked him out in cuffs. Then suddenly, once he was in the back of the cop car, they all started looking at me. I can safely say without a shadow of doubt that this was the single worst moment of my life so far. It was a cocktail of absolute horror for me. Everyone's eyes on me, coupled with the embarrassment of having my date arrested while assuming everyone was thinking, "What kind of girl goes out with a murder suspect? Is she dumb? Is she in on it?" It was just awful. And then it hit me that if he really had killed some poor girl, was I his next intended victim? Did I just avoid being murdered by a matter of minutes, hours, days, or weeks? Was he looking at me with those big warm brown eyes while thinking, "She's so smart and pretty"? Or was he looking at me all hungry because he couldn't wait to hurt me? I barely remember walking out of the bistro, and the next day when I returned to pick my car up, I had to ask the maitre d' if I'd walked out without paying. Turns out I hadn't actually paid, but the restaurant's owner overheard about the whole thing and told me that all the food and drink we'd consumed was on the house. It's a little acts of kindness like this which slowly restored my faith in humanity, because, believe it, it had been badly shaken by the events of that Valentine's evening. I only really remember getting into the front seat of my car, calling my mom, then just ugly sobbing into the phone while she asked me, "Are you okay? What happened, honey?" over and over again. Once I was finally able to get the words out, she told me not to drive home in such a state and to take a cab, and she was right. Even though I hadn't touched a drop of alcohol that evening, I was definitely in no fit state to drive. I suppose at that point I should just cut to the chase and tell you all what you want to know. And yes, Ryan was convicted of murdering the girl whose name I've chosen to omit. I was actually kind of hoping it was all just some horrible mistake, and that I hadn't seemed so dumb or naive to have gone on a date with an actual murderer. But nope. As the months went on, it progressed from an arrest, to a trial, to a full-on murder conviction. Ryan had gone on a date with some sweet, unsuspecting girl, taken her back to his apartment, then strangled her to death in the middle of being intimate. I remember my roommate saying that it might have been a kind of horrid accident, but it wasn't. Ryan had deliberately killed her, at a time when she literally couldn't have been more vulnerable. It might seem strange, but I did end up finding a kind of closure after the whole thing, and I recommend this variety of cognitive behavioral therapy to anyone who suffered a similar trauma. I wrote Ryan a letter, or more accurately, I wrote a letter to a prisoner number and addressed it to the correctional facility he was being held at. I couldn't even bear to write his name, nor could I bring myself to write mine either. He'd know who I was certain of it. And in the letter, I told him in no uncertain terms that I hoped he would rot and burn forever. I told him a bunch of other things too, but those aren't fit enough to be reprinted anywhere remotely civilized. I don't know if he ever opened or read the letter, but the detective that I was in contact with informed me that it would most certainly be delivered. I hope he read my letter, and I hope it cut him up inside. I wanted him to feel as mortified and ashamed as I did in that bistro on that chilly Valentine's evening. I wanted him to read my words, and as he was reading, I wanted him to pray for the ground to just open up wide and swallow him whole, just as I did when all those people were looking at me with burning judgment in their eyes. I wanted so many things from that letter, but I only got one of them. Closure. Some of you might be wondering why I haven't named anyone or anyone in this account. It's for a number of reasons, but the primary one, I know this for certain, is that the family of the girl my date had murdered requested the privacy and space to grieve following his trial. Unfortunately, this wasn't respected by elements of the local and national media, and the family ended up suing one of the more unscrupulous publications regarding an article they posted online. If you ask me, it was righteous litigation, and although I wouldn't be all that worried about them suing me, given how closely connected I am with the case, I'd like to respect their wishes for privacy and anonymity. On top of that, I'd like you to respect my privacy and anonymity, at least until my prospective killer is released. Because then, I'll go public, truly public, and no matter how much my prospective killer tries to carve out a new life, a new identity, or a new existence, I'm determined to make sure that everyone knows what a monster he really is. Back when I was still in high school, I used to work as a waiter at this super fancy restaurant on the corner of the common. I worked there for 2 Valentine's days, and I've never understood why people didn't want to work them. Not the first year, anyway. Tips, they were awesome. So the next year, when I wasn't even on shift, it was real easy just to make a swap so I could get all those Valentine's tips. So, this guy comes in, good-looking dude, but his girl was like Rihanna level hot. It was all eyes on her all night long. There was almost a fistfight in the back to decide who got to wait that table. Okay, maybe not a fistfight, but I personally witnessed 2 games of rock, paper, scissors, and they were low-key intense. Anyway, the night goes on, we're working steadily, and the tips are just mounting up hour by hour. The dude was treating his girl to all kinds of bougie cocktails, insisting she have dessert, the most expensive entree, stuff like that. And the whole time, we're just like, yes, dude, boost that percentage. Boost it. It wasn't my table, so I couldn't keep track of the exact amount he dropped on her, but I know it must have been like 500 and change based on the pricing. But as they're wrapping up, I'm just waiting to see what kind of cut I'd be getting. When out of nowhere, a solo girl walks into the main dining area. She's not wearing anything fancy. She's looking like she'd actually been crying, and I remember watching her look around the dining room for a second or two before honing in on the dude and his Rihanna twin. You know when you just know something messed up is about to happen, and you can just feel the tension rising in the room before it suddenly explodes? I think everyone in the main dining room picked up on that as she powered over to the Rihanna girl and started screaming in her face. I remember watching our bartender, this big tattooed dude called Harley, walking over to her, getting ready to separate them or whatever. But before he got there, the crazy girl grabs one of the wine glasses from the table and just yeets it into the Rihanna girl's face. Harley goes from 0 to 100 trying to get over to stop it. This place was super fancy, so it didn't have security or anything hanging around anywhere. In fact, we barely had any trouble at all. So when the situation exploded, and diners were screaming and trying to get away, Harley was slowed down by all these people trying to get out of the dining room while he was trying to get in. Then, in the meantime, the girl is just going ham on Rihanna with this broken wine glass. Before I actually come out of shock in time to act on it, she's picked up another glass and yeeted that one into her face too. Then get this, instead of actually helping his date, the guy actually just bailed out of the booth and ran out of the restaurant along with the rest of the customers. Total scumbag move, man, and something I'll never forget. Seconds later, me, Harley, and the rest of the waiting staff had basically body slammed the crazy girl away from Rihanna, while she herself had slumped down under the table to get away from the attack. The cops eventually showed up, took the crazy girl away, and once the scene was safe and clear, the EMTs showed up to treat the injured girl. I hadn't seen her at any point after the attack, not until the EMTs actually started treating her. And honestly, I couldn't even recognize her face. All around her eyes and nose, it just looked like ripped up red, and her upper lip was almost cut all the way in half so you could see gums and teeth and stuff. It was one of the most horrific, upsetting things I'd ever seen. And every single Valentine's Day since, I'm reminded of that poor girl and the horrific injuries she suffered at the hands of that psycho ex, or whoever she was.
My grandfather grew up in Jacksonville, Texas back in the 1950s, and if you've never been there, you wouldn't be missing much. He grew up the eldest of five brothers and sisters on a farm with my great-grandparents. He passed away about a year ago, but I wanted to share a story he told me when I came home from college break. Naturally, Grandpa didn't come from much. His parents' generation suffered through the Great Depression, and farmers didn't fare off too well. But being the gritty Texas farm folk that they were, they thrived in it. Having a farm and a big pasture surrounded by pine trees made for a good childhood, as he told me. He would reminisce about the times of gathering the whole town's kids and playing baseball games to pass the hot summer days. Though as his health deteriorated, he began to talk more deeply with me, and would talk to me about life lessons, and one thing in particular, fear. He asked me if I had ever heard of witches. I said of course, but he stopped me, and as serious as he could be, he asked me again. "Listen, I ain't talking about no Halloween characters. I'm talking about actual witches." I could tell it made him uncomfortable talking about it. It really screwed him up as a kid. He explained to me that he had three encounters growing up. The first time he saw her, he was 10. He and his siblings were playing around sundown. They were outside in the pasture. About 200 yards away from him, there was a tree line where a forest began. He said that he saw a dark floating silhouette by the tree line. He couldn't focus on it because of the lack of lighting, but he swore to me that the figure's head was cocked at a perfect 90-degree angle looking right at him. He said it was inhuman. He remembers rushing the little ones back inside and telling his parents. Their parents never let them out after sundown again. The second encounter came 2 years later. He and a friend who was their closest neighbor would walk on a trail through the forest to school every day. He said it was about a 2.5-mile walk. One day as they were walking home, they saw a homeless person covered in quilts walking on the left side of the trail. Being very confused and uneasy as to why somebody they didn't know who was completely submerged in dirty quilts would be walking on this trail in the woods. As the person passed, he said they both smelled something that was a mix of rot and sour. Upon smelling the putrid odor, Grandpa said that he became very dizzy and incoherent, and the neighbor boy felt the same way. A few moments later, they hear a sinister giggle from behind them. They turn to see this person, who was still completely hidden by the quilts, began running after them. He said the thing didn't stop chasing them until they busted down the front door of the farmhouse. He never saw the neighbor boy again after that day. The incident was widely spread around town and quickly became a warning for all those who would venture in the woods. The third and last time he saw the witch was when he was a senior in high school. Grandpa was going to be a Division I football player for the University of Oklahoma and quite frankly was the hometown hero. He said that he just met my grandmother and really wanted to enjoy the rest of his senior year. So he attended a prom after party in the woods with his classmates. Being that his class only had 60 people, everyone was there. He admitted that he got pretty wasted that night. He went to go take a leak a couple of yards away from the bonfire. While he was draining his lizard, he heard shuffling noises from nearby. As he tried to focus, he made out a small hut through the trees. There was a stream of smoke emanating from its chimney. He smelled a stench that he recognized from when he was 12. He told me that nothing else could have sobered him up so quickly. He proceeded to investigate the hut deep in the forest. As he approached, a dark figure appeared from the shadows. But he told me that no matter how hard he tried, he never could quite make it out. All of a sudden, the figure started to whisper. It intensified, and he felt a burning sensation on his arm. He felt as if his body was being branded. The figure then slowly faded back into the darkness of the forest. He became frantic and realized that he was now 100 yards away from everyone. He said that there was no way he had wandered off that far. He began screaming for help. He admitted to me that he even wet his pants. The creepiest part about this story is that the police investigated the hut that my grandpa discovered. Inside was a gore fest. There was dead animals strewn about the floor, as well as human remains, who some believed to be the missing neighbor boy. They never found out who was responsible, and my grandfather moved away shortly after. My grandfather was a fantastic man, and I miss him a lot. He was the most kind, loving man I ever knew, and I know that he wouldn't make any of this up. And I've also always wondered where he got the burn mark on his arm. Some backstory before I begin. I work for a conservation corps based out of Austin, Texas. We do a lot of environmentally based projects, such as trail maintenance, wildfire fighting, invasive species removal, etc. One day this past spring, we were working in Jasper, Texas, doing invasive species removal on Nature Conservancy property. We were clearing any and all species that were not longleaf, shortleaf, or loblolly pine trees. The property was about 60 acres, so we were flying through this project trying to complete it. Most of our chainsaws had run into problems and were not working properly, so we ended up having to split up into groups. I worked in a crew of 8, and we only had 4 saws running, so groups of 2 was the reasonable way to run things. I was working with one of my co-workers, Joe. We were on an area of property that the crew had not been to yet. Our job was to cut a trail about a mile into the property and proceed to make our way around the 60 acres. We began to saw our way in at around 7:45 a.m. We had to hike in our fuel, bar oil for the chainsaw, our wedges, and our packs. We each carried a hatchet in case we needed an extra wedge or for any other reason, as well as flagging to mark the trail. At around 9, we had reached our halfway point and decided to take a short break. I shut off the chainsaw, took my chaps off, and drank some water to cool off. I placed my pack against the tree, and Joe did the same. We began shooting the shit. Nothing unusual. Just some stupid banter to get through the day. As we were talking, something snapped in the brush about 30 feet to the west of us. I instantly stopped talking and grabbed our hatchets. This area was known to have wild boar. We knew what to do in this situation if a wild boar was to show up. Nevertheless, we were scared. We slowly walked over to the brush, and as we approached, another snap came from our south, about 30 feet in the dense brush. At that point, we were starting to get nervous. We had no plan if 2 boar were to show up. We decided that it was best to grab our packs and find our way back to the crew. They would understand us ceasing work for 2 boar. As we slowly made our way back to our packs, snaps came from every direction. We had nowhere to go. My first thought was to grab the chainsaw and turn it on. I revved up the engine, but it promptly died. Great, another saw down. In simple terms, we were screwed. We decided to make a run for it at that point. I counted down from 5, and we both ran down the trail as fast as we could into the thick swampy brush. We sprinted as fast as humanly possible towards camp, but something made us stop. Joe and I, at the same moment, stopped running. We stood there, not knowing what to do. Joe began to look around frantically, and as he did, I felt a cold breeze wisp down my back. A deep voice whispered something into my ear, but before I could even comprehend the words, I took my hatchet and swung blindly behind me. To my surprise and terror, it struck something hard. As I turned my head to see what creature had just met its doom, I heard Joe gasp. As my head swiveled, behind me was a tree. This may sound normal, but we had cleared this area of all life not but 30 minutes prior. The chances of us missing a 2-foot-wide, 60-foot-tall tree were 0. Realizing that this was only a tree, I looked back at Joe, ready to laugh. But as soon as I turned around, Joe was gone. I chuckled and started to call out his name. After about 2 minutes, I began to freak out. I began frantically searching the surrounding area, but Joe seemed to have vanished into nothing. After another 10 minutes of searching, I decided that he may have been so scared that he ran back to camp, so I began to make my way back. When I arrived, everything was completely normal. Everything but the fact that Joe wasn't there. I told everyone that Joe had gone missing after we had a run-in with some boar. We all spread out. We looked for Joe for an hour before deciding to call the authorities. They arrived shortly after. We set up search parties to find Joe. After about 10 minutes of searching, he was found. Joe sat on a tree stump, pale as the moon, staring off into space. I called out to him, but when he looked at me, I noticed blood running down his stomach. There was a tree branch sticking out of Joe's gut. I sprinted over to him as he fainted and caught him before he hit the ground. The police rushed Joe to the nearest hospital. Before we left, I noticed something odd. Joe had been sitting on a stump of a tree that I had rammed my hatchet into. The tree was no longer standing, and my hatchet was sitting in the dirt, covered in blood. My stomach dropped, and I immediately walked with my crew back to camp, leaving my hatchet behind. We packed up our campsite and left Jasper that night. We were never sent back to that property. Shortly after, an article surfaced in the news of a nature conservancy surveyor who disappeared in the same forest. They found him a week later impaled next to a tree stump. I can only assume it was the same stump that we found Joe next to.
I experienced this back when I was 14. Now I am 23 years old. Back then I lived on the outskirts of a small town in Montana. Behind my home there was a forest. Now, I had never stepped a foot into those woods until that day. The only time I'd ever even gotten close to that forest was when I was tasked with walking my family dog, Charlie. Now, Charlie was a big dog. I had never seen him cower before. On one of our walks, I heard a noise in the woods. It was the sound of a branch snapping. Occasionally, whenever I took walks with Charlie, I would keep hearing these noises. One thing to mention, though, is that whenever I took Charlie out during the day, nothing would happen. But during dusk or dawn or even nighttime, I would always hear this noise. The day I decided to head in was an extraordinary day because it was my 14th birthday. After everyone was in bed, I had snuck out with Charlie and we navigated our way through, or, well, tried to. We ended up getting lost and came upon an abandoned shed. Then, the last thing I expected happened. Charlie started whimpering. That was never a good sign. I had wondered if there was someone there, but I couldn't see anybody. I didn't think I would need any form of protection, so I didn't have any. And then, I heard the sounds. A crunch here and a snap there, and the animals went quiet. I was terrified, so all I could do was run to the shed and hide. Something got closer. I heard the leaves crunching. It was the only way I could tell how close it was. Then, a loud bang resonated through the woods. It was walking on top of the roof. I couldn't stop shaking, but I'd like to think that Charlie could tell how scared I was because he started licking me. Around 5 or 10 minutes later, it hopped off the roof and I peeked out the nearest window. There was a human-like creature out there, grotesque, with long limbs. Pale skin like the moon, jagged bones and joints. It was extremely thin. Its spine was protruding underneath its skin. Instead of bumps on the spine, they were like tips of a knife. I felt sick to my stomach, and I almost hurled right then and there. I felt like I was seeing something I shouldn't. I managed to see its face. It was roundish. Its eyes were beady and black. They looked soulless, but I'm not completely sure. They were glassy like the eyes of a doll, lifeless, and soon it had started to walk away, but not without turning back to me and letting out this demonic roar, like the roar of a lion mixed with the call of a raven. I think it knew I was there. I don't know what prevented it from killing me, but whatever it was, I'm eternally grateful. Remember, if there are woods near you, and you hear strange sounds, never forget that there are things out there that won't be as merciful as it was to me. If anybody knows what this may have been, please let me know in the comments down below. I'm incredibly curious.
It all started on the 7th of February.
The small independent coffee shop I was working at had decided to throw up a few decorations for Valentine's Day. So myself and a few colleagues had spent pretty much our entire shift putting up pink and red bunting, writing romantic quotations around the edges of our blackboard menu, and other romantically themed stuff. It was a fun way to spend a shift, but as I clocked out and began the short walk back to my flat, I began to feel a slight pang of loneliness, knowing I'd be single and alone on the day itself. I considered Tinder or Bumble to try and bag myself a date, but the chances of securing myself a boy that I actually genuinely liked over the next 7 days was slim to none, so I resigned myself to another Valentine's on my own. But when I got home to find a pink envelope in my mailbox, I must admit that it brought a little smile to my face. A secret admirer, like something right out of a cheap romance paperback, might not be every girl's cup of tea. But to be honest, it really cheered me up, even if it was from a friend or the nice lady that lived on the ground floor flat. Only when I open the thing up, it just says, 7 days to go. No romantic message, no kisses or hearts, just those three words scrawled hastily onto the paper inside. It's then I realized there's nothing on the envelope or the paper it contained that confirmed it was actually addressed to me. No name, no address, nothing. I started to feel a tad silly, like, what if it wasn't meant for me at all? What if someone had sent their little Valentine's card to the wrong person? I told myself I was just being silly, but kept the envelope and card as I walked upstairs to my flat and got on with my evening. I honestly think I'd forgotten the whole thing by the next morning when I got up and set off to work again. But when I got home, there was a stark reminder that this was no mistake. Arriving back at my flat, I checked my mail to find yet another pink envelope inside. Not only that, but a small brown paper package was stuffed inside too. Again, I have to admit to being kind of excited about the whole thing. There definitely hadn't been a mistake of address or anything. I mean, the person must have had to put all that stuff in there themselves. Maybe I really did have a secret admirer, and that Valentine's was about to become something out of a fairy tale. But as soon as I opened the package, I knew something wasn't quite right. Inside was a small brown teddy bear. Only it wasn't newly bought, nor had it been looked after very well in what was obviously a long and grubby existence. To be frank, it was filthy. The thing looked like it hadn't been washed in years, decades even. The fur was all grimy and matted together, and one of its glasses was missing, probably having been pulled out by a child some years before. The note inside the envelope was pretty much the same as the last one. Only this time it read, 6 days to go. That's about the time that I realized that whoever was sending these wasn't exactly all there, and what had previously been a kind of giddy excitement turned into nervous anticipation. And the more I let my mind dwell on it, the more and more frightened I became. This wasn't going to be some dream romance. In fact, it was more likely to be the polar opposite. I told a friend in work about the whole thing, and they seemed to take it much more seriously than I had. They told me I obviously had a stalker, that even if this person was doing this stuff out of affection, it was still crossing a number of personal boundaries, and I should consider contacting the police. But to tell them exactly what? That I had a note addressed to no one, from no one, with absolutely no other details than I'd found them in my mailbox. Alright, it wasn't exactly the dream romantic gestures that I think all girls kind of crave, but at the same time, why cause someone the distress of calling the cops on them? That felt kind of cruel. But after returning home that evening to something else in my apartment, I didn't feel so apprehensive about contacting them. I arrived home again that evening to find exactly what I expected in my mailbox. Another note, this time reading, yep, you guessed it. 5 days to go. I stormed up to my apartment, grabbed a piece of notepaper and a Sharpie, and wrote out something along the lines of, "Whoever is leaving stuff in my mailbox, please stop. It was sweet at first, but now it's kind of creepy. No more, or I call the police." I made an effort not to come across as too rude or aggressive, but I also needed to make it clear that I really, really didn't appreciate their unwanted attention. I taped the note to the front entrance of my apartment building before I went to bed, hoping whoever it was would get the message and leave me alone. So, little side note, I get a shower before bed every night without fail. I'm almost sort of a clean freak. I keep my bathroom pretty much spotless. So as I finish getting washed, something small catches my eye. Something that might not even gain the attention of most people, but to me, it stuck out like a sore thumb. A flash of color in what is an otherwise pristine white bathroom. On the window's ledge was a tiny, glassy dome shape, just sat there on its own. I approach curiously, peering down at it for a few moments before I completely freaked out and ran out of the bathroom to call the cops. It was a small, glass eye, a minuscule amount of fabric woven into the back of it. I recognized it almost instantly as the missing eye from the teddy bear that I'd found in my mailbox. While I was on the phone to the police, I realized a few things about my prospective Valentine. As I said, I get a shower every evening before bed. I like hot showers, the steamier the better, so naturally the bathroom windows spends a lot of time ajar to let out the moisture. Whoever managed to put that glass eye on the bathroom window ledge had known my evening routine. They had obviously been watching me for long enough to work out the exact place to put something so that I'd see it. But it was their method that really creeped me out. The way they used the small teddy's eye to tell me in so many words that they were watching me. I swapped the note out I'd written for one that simply read, "The police have been contacted. Leave me alone." And leave me alone they did. But the whole thing had a pretty serious effect on my psyche for a long time afterwards. Sometimes I'd find myself staring at someone in the coffee shop or someone walking past my flat, wondering if it was them. If one day one of them would look over and smile. And I'd just know they'd not given up just yet.